Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Janet Yellen talks interest rates and how violence affects the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced today that all military combat jobs will be open to women by early next year. That includes jobs in the special forces, like Navy SEALs. The decision could change the career paths of women in the military by removing what's been a barrier to their advancement. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Combat jobs are gritty, on the front lines, in infantry and artillery units. Nancy Duff Campbell is co-president of the National Women's Law Center. She says women have unofficially been in combat for a long time.
Women in combat support units who are traveling on trucks that get blown up have been obviously in combat.
Genevieve Chase was in one of those trucks. The Army Sergeant First Class was in Afghanistan in April of 2006 when her truck was rammed by a car filled with explosives. She suffered burns and a brain injury. Now opportunities that were officially denied to her for years are open.
It's sort of emotional day for me. Sorry, I'm going to cry.
Chase has been in the military for 13 years and may leave it soon, but she thinks the opening of combat jobs will make the military more attractive for women now.
This is everything I would have dreamed of when I joined the military, and I didn't think that I would see it happen during my career.
But an official combat job could have boosted Chase's career. That's because you don't rise to the top positions in the military unless you have a combat job. Thomas Ricks is a contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine.
These combat slots, ground combat, are the express elevator for U.S. military promotions.
Rick says we won't see women immediately leading combat units. It generally takes 20 years of combat experience to rise to the very top. But he says this is a start. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen told lawmakers today the central bank is getting close to raising interest rates. She gave generally upbeat testimony to Congress's Joint Economic Committee. But as the prospects for a rate hike grow here in the U.S., the European Central Bank is taking the opposite approach, cutting its already negative interest rates. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
If you thought interest rates couldn't go below zero, so did a lot of economists, until central banks in Switzerland, Sweden, and Denmark proved otherwise. Bernie Baumol is chief global economist at the Economic Outlook Group. He says for more than a year now, instead of paying interest, the European Central Bank has been charging banks to hold their cash overnight.
What they're trying to do is motivate these institutions to lend more to the private sector. And certainly one way to do that is sort of to penalize these banks for having their money simply, you know, sit idly.
There are some signs that it may be working, says Joe Gagno. He's a former Fed economist, now with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Gagno says bank loans are growing in Europe again.
What people point to more than anything is this pushing the euro down, because international investors have gotten out of euros and are putting their money in dollars instead, where they can get at least a small positive interest rate instead of a negative rate.
And that is good for European exports, but not good enough for ECB President Mario Draghi, who notched the deposit rate down another 0.1% today. The question is just how negative can rates go? Francesco Papadia with the Bruegel Institute in Brussels says so far banks have been reluctant to pass on their costs to regular depositors.
But at a certain point, if this would go on, they would be forced to do it.
At that point, the mattress at home or a bank vault starts looking like a better option. And if customers start pulling their money out of bank accounts in droves, Gagneau says we'll have learned how low we can go. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Markets today, they were also figuring out how low they could go. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's the fourth day of the UN's Conference on Climate Change in Paris. China has pledged to cut its carbon emission levels, which are currently the highest on the planet. And if you've seen pictures of Chinese cities grayed out by smog, you know the country's got a long way to go. The government's restricted the number of coal-fired power plants that can be built in the eastern part of the country, where most of the people live. But China still needs that coal power. It burns more coal than the rest of the world combined. As Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports, the far west region of Xinjiang is about to go on a coal-burning bender.
A newly built expressway along the edge of the Gobi Desert. The only signs of life here are wild camels. After a few hours of driving, the smokestacks appear. Then, the skeletons of a city. This place is called Jingdong. Underneath it is China's largest integrated coal field, 390 billion metric tons of coal, 7% of the country's reserves, enough to power China for 100 years. Air pollution, much of it from burning coal, has hit a crisis point along China's east coast. So now China's building new coal-fired power plants here, thousands of miles away at the opposite end of the country.
We're building a city here. See over there? That's going to be the new city hall. And over there, an international hotel.
A man installing sprinklers for a row of wilting trees stops to point out partially built landmarks of a future desert city of 500,000 people. Beyond the construction, giant excavators scrape the earth inside strip mines that circle the city. Much of the coal is burned here at one of at least six power plants rising from the desert. Gan Yiwei, an energy campaigner at Greenpeace in Beijing, says Jingdong, part of a broader push to transfer coal burning to China's far west, brings a host of environmental challenges with it.
China's northwest is dry, and coal projects like these require a lot of water. Developing these projects will impact the little water that's left in some of these areas.
And near Jingdong, water is in short supply. It borders a nature reserve along the western fringe of the Gobi Desert. And on this day, the desert air is filled with smog.
Developing coal in this region is good for eastern China's air. But this is just transferring air pollution from one part of China to another.
In return, energy will be transferred in the opposite direction. Gas processed from the coal mined here in Jingdong will be piped thousands of miles to eastern China starting in 2017. That same year, electricity from burning coal at this site will begin to travel along a network of ultra-high voltage transmission lines that'll span the length of the country. All this new transmission is promising for Xinjiang's vibrant wind and solar energy industries, too. But Yu Wuming, former CEO of Goldwind, China's largest wind turbine manufacturer, is worried.
China's grid used to dismiss solar and wind power, but now renewables are becoming so big they're threatening the profit of coal. The grid has traditionally been tied to coal and their profits are bundled together. It's a difficult problem to solve.
But it's a problem the market is already helping to solve. China's economic slowdown means coal consumption has dropped nearly 8% in the last 2 years. Zhou Xizhou, analyst for IHS, says this will help Chinese leader Xi Jinping reach the promises he made during a summit with President Obama this year to dramatically cut China's carbon emissions. Zhou says China's Ministry of Environment has already rejected proposals for new projects that would have turned coal into gas.
So there is obviously a camp in Beijing that is very much opposed to these kinds of projects. And of course, there's an industrial development camp that still want to see these projects go forward, especially in the local areas where it does create economic output and jobs. So this is going to be, you know, a long-term struggle between different schools of thoughts in the Chinese government.
One thing the two sides can agree on is that the Earth's climate is in trouble, and China plays a big role in solving the problem.
When we are in government meetings, you really don't see a whole lot of debate on the fact that something needs to be done. And certainly nobody's disputing the science of climate change.
China's top leadership is filled with former engineers with strong backgrounds in science. Intellectually, they understand what's at stake. Plus, they're surrounded by the evidence of decades of environmental neglect. Joe says it's a refreshing change from the small but vociferous group of lawmakers in the United States who deny the science behind climate change altogether. In China's northwest region of Xinjiang, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Check out photos of what Rob calls China's Las Vegas of the coal industry. That's at marketplace.org. Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agency, has lowered the ratings of eight of the country's largest banks down a notch. And we're talking about the big guys here. Banks like JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley. The why is the interesting part of the story. S&P thinks the banks are now less likely to get a government bailout in a future crisis. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
After the financial crisis and the bank bailouts and all that talk about too big to fail, the Dodd-Frank financial reforms of 2010 set up new rules to try and make banks more responsible for themselves. Stuart Plesser with S&P says they think those reforms are now far enough along.
It's less likely that the government would come in and support U.S. banks.
Not impossible, just less likely. Plesser says the old assumption that government would support big banks, that had bumped banks' ratings up a notch. No more.
It had immense value.
Daniel Carpenter is a professor at Harvard.
The implicit guarantee from the notion that the taxpayers and the government could bail out the banks allowed them to open lots of subsidiaries and to take on additional risk.
Carpenter says S&P's move shows it believes the risk has now shifted from the taxpayer to the banks themselves and their shareholders or bondholders. David Wessel with the Brookings Institution says that would be a good thing for all of us. So if the downgrade then feels counterintuitive, remember, Standard & Poor's isn't judging the safety of the American financial system.
Their job is to tell people who buy bank bonds, what risk do you have here? So any change that moves the risk more towards the shareholders and bondholders and away from the taxpayers may be good for America, but may not be good for bank bondholders.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
New York's Public Service Commission is assigning a new area code to Manhattan. 332 will join 646, 917, and the oh-so-classic 212. WNYC's Janet Babin reports on how the new number is being received and just how much three little digits can signify.
It may be irrational, but many people have an emotional connection to their area code, like Alexis Grinnell. The political columnist grew up in the Bronx with 212, but it got changed to 718.
But it felt like we were being banished to a separate island.
Grinnell was 11. She says the new area code made her feel like she was part of some strange new tribe.
Who are these 718 people? What are we now? What has happened to my city, my identity? Where do I fit in?
She's in Brooklyn now, and don't ask this native New Yorker to give up her 917 cell phone.
My 917 cell phone area code is tangible proof that I got here first.
It might have all started in California, another big place where identity is hard to hone.
People can ask me, like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm from the 909.
SoCal resident Michael Pecker writes for Rant Now. One of his pieces talked about his attachment to his 909 area code when he left home for college in North Carolina.
Yeah, it's like people just don't really care about area codes other places.
Area codes appear to matter most when people make emotional decisions. Real estate brokers say a local area code is reassuring. Sources are more likely to call back a reporter with a local number. And they matter in politics, too, says software developer David Caldwell. He used to do field organizing for candidates in Ohio and still lives there.
Voters were more likely to pick up if they knew the area code from which the voter was being called. In other words, if it came from something that they recognized.
The 332 code will start getting assigned in 2017. It'll be local, but it could signal newcomer. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this is not me in an apartment, you know, setting up a green screen and announcing my favorite games. I mean, this is a, you know, a multi-million dollar award show.
The Oscars of Video Game Awards. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 252 points, 1.4%, to close at 17,477. The Nasdaq lost 85 points, 1.2%, to finish at 5037. And the S&P 500 fell 29 points, 1.4%, to end at 2049. Investors withdrew from the banking sector on news of that S&P ratings cut we told you about earlier. JPMorgan Chase off 1.2%. Goldman Sachs slid 2.6%. Morgan Stanley dropped 1.25%. Citigroup shed 1.1%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Want to know what color you'll be wearing next year? What color you'll be painting your nails and maybe decorating your house? Look no further than the Pantone Color of the Year, or Colors of the Year. The trend forecasting company Pantone Color Institute has picked a light pink and a light blue for 2016, specifically rose quartz and serenity. The company says those are, quote, colors that psychologically fulfill our yearning for reassurance and security. Maybe. Turns out, though, those color choices actually matter to designers. Ashley Gross of KPLU in Seattle has a story, which begins not in New York or Paris, but on a rainy Pacific Northwest island.
Bainbridge Island, west of Seattle, is a pretty foggy, drab-looking place this time of year. This is home for Leatrice Eisman, executive director of the Pantone Color Institute. She gives a tour of her garden, and even in late fall, she notices lots of color.
Let me see. I want to start with the hydrangeas because they always amaze me.
Many of us might ignore those drooping flowers and just see brown leaves degrading into dirt. Not Eisman.
Hydrangeas, I think, are sometimes more beautiful when they have died than when they're alive.
She points out shades of pink and blue that still tinge the blossoms. As it turns out, those are the colors that she and her team picked for 2016. Eisman has spent her whole life noticing the way colors work together. It runs in her family. Her mom would paint the inside of their home in Baltimore a new shade every spring, even the piano. Once, her mom painted the broiler.
Which was not a good idea, because the next time she plugged it in, of course, we almost had the house burned down. But that's the kind of encouragement that I got when I was a kid.
Now Eisman and her team travel the world to spot color trends. They look at upcoming art exhibits, movies that are going to come out, what fashion designers are working on. They try to figure out what shade matches how people are feeling. 2010 was turquoise, a hint of a tropical vacation in the midst of a lousy economy. This past year was Marsala, a dark red that reminds people of wine and eating a good meal.
The color has to have some symbolic meaning. What are people telling us their needs are, and how can we help to fulfill those needs with a symbolic color?
In a Seattle neighborhood filled with tech workers, almost no one has heard of the 2015 color Marsala.
Didn't know that? Never heard of that word before.
No, I don't even know what that is. Marsala? Like the wine?
That was Jennifer Turner and Johnny Boyscher. In the design world, though, the color of the year is a big deal. And even more important to designers are Pantone's big books of color chips. Those chips are numbered so that printers anywhere in the world can get the exact shade.
I would say it's as important to us as Apple computers are, Mac computers, or the Adobe software that we use.
Joseph Hughes is art director at Adcom, an ad agency in Cleveland. He says he pays attention to the color of the year, but he doesn't go bonkers incorporating each new shade.
If you kind of misuse one of these trendy colors, you're going to end up with something that's going to really look old in a couple years.
Eisman doesn't expect everyone to rush out and cloak themselves in the latest color. She just wants people to experiment. Eisman says she's even inspired some of her neighbors on Bainbridge Island to break out of their Northwest neutrals.
They will walk up to me and say, Lee, look, okay, there's your color of the year. Do you like it? What do you think? And I get such a big kick out of that. It gets people involved in the usage of color. And that's what it's all about for me.
To keep her own spirits up in the rainy months, Eisman has painted her living room a light yellow to evoke sunlight. And she painted one bathroom, even the ceiling, maroon. Because, well, why not? In Seattle, I'm Ashley Gross for Marketplace. Tonight, what are basically the Oscars of the video game world will be handed out. The Game Awards will take place at the Microsoft Theater in downtown Los Angeles, the same place the Emmys are hosted. The awards are independent, created just last year by Jeff Keighley, and they don't air on television, but they're expected to attract millions of viewers on streaming services, platforms like Twitch. I met up with Keighley at the theater and asked him why he decided to get into the video game award show business.
Well, I'd worked for many years at Viacom and a network called Spike TV, working on what was the Video Game Awards there, and really fell in love with the gaming industry and the opportunity, I think, to recognize these creators. Because a lot of these game creators make, you know their games, right? You know Call of Duty, you know Grand Theft Auto, you know Candy Crush, but you don't necessarily know who makes them. And I've always felt that they're some of the most creative individuals out there in the entertainment field. So I wanted to create a platform for them. And it became clear that the way distribution works online, you don't necessarily need a big network to put something like this together. You can reach this audience on your own.
And how do you explain to your parents mm-hmm. that you're not on a traditional television channel?
I mean, I think we even get that from a lot of celebrity talent and stuff. What was fascinating to me was last year we were on Instagram during the show watching what people were saying about it, and we saw all these pictures of folks sitting in their living room watching the show on their television sets. It sort of dawned on me, it's like, of course they are, because they're, you know, watching it on their Apple TV on television, or they're watching it through their Xbox on the YouTube app. So people always ask me, it's like, oh, well, you know, when are you going to get back on television? And that's not a goal for me anymore. You have to sort of explain to people that it is a very different approach. And when you come in and you've seen our set, I mean, you've seen the scale of what we're doing. This is not me in an apartment, you know, setting up a green screen and announcing my favorite games. I mean, this is a multi-million dollar award show.
And is it a moneymaker for you?
It wasn't last year, but, you know, you sort of have to forward invest in things like this and build them. This year, I think hopefully we're going to do a little better with it. But, you know, this show is double in scale to what we did last year. So my view on this is that, you know, we need to kind of continue investing and building this into a franchise. So it's not really about making money right now. I think it's about trying to break even, trying to kind of scale up what we're doing. And then, you know, I feel like gaming is not going anywhere. And I've been playing games since I was a kid, and I get excited about, you know, 20 years from now, what a show like this can look like. And the format of what we're doing, streaming it to everyone digitally, being able to get sponsors and everyone involved, like, this is the future.
For folks who aren't gamers, mm-hmm. what should they understand about this business that they don't?
Well, I think, you know, the thing that's unique about gaming is that it's interactive entertainment. And it's really empowering that you can, you know, play through amazing stories and choose, you know, your own adventure. And it's like, do you want to go left? Do you want to go right?
Are you a good guy or a bad guy?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, all those choices,
I'm
right?
Asking you. Yeah. How do you play?
Depends
your games?
On the day. Well, the great thing is you can sort of go either way. I tend to like to be evil because you can, right? And it's sort of that sense of escapism, right? It's you can you can be who you want to be or who you don't want to be, but you can get out you know, those thoughts in a game. And that's part of the fun of it, is really the imagination and the creativity that gaming brings out in you. And that's what's exciting, I think, to everyone that plays games, is that you know they're only going to get better.
Jeff Keighley is executive producer of The Game Awards. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
This final note before we go. As we mentioned at the top of the show, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen hinted to Congress today that an interest rate hike could come later this month. And that's the lead. But there was something else. A member of Congress asked Yellen about the impact violence might have on our economy. Things like terrorism, mass shootings, here and abroad. Here's what she had to say.
So those risks are ones that we watch very carefully, and I would agree with you that it does have the potential to have a significant economic effect. I would not say that I see a significant effect at this point.
But she pointed to the cautious behavior of households and firms since the financial crisis and went on.
Well, I think there are many different factors that contribute to that. Cautious behavior, the crisis itself, the slow growth we've seen. Many businesses talk about regulatory uncertainty. I would add geopolitical risk as a further factor that is causing that kind of cautiousness.
Today, the Dow declined 252 points, 1.4%. The Nasdaq lost 85 points, 1.2%. And the S&P 500 fell 29 points, 1.4%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai's going to be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.